Welcome everyone to The Demand Side. I'm your host, Edward Brown. On today's episode, we're talking about U.S. fiscal policy and how persistent fiscal mismanagement by our leaders threatens the future of the American economy. Here to discuss is our very special guest, Bill Gale. Bill is a senior fellow in the Economic Studies program at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on fiscal policy, tax policy, and savings behavior. He is also the co-director of the Tax Policy Center, a joint venture of the Brookings Institution and the Urban Institute. Bill has written extensively in policy-related publications, including op-eds for CNN, the Financial Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. And he's the author of a terrific book that we will be discussing quite a bit today, Fiscal Therapy, Curing America's Debt Addiction and Investing in the Future. Prior to joining Brookings in 1992, he was an assistant economics professor at UCLA, and he also served as a senior economist in President George H.W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Bill, we're happy to have you on the show. Today, we are largely going to be discussing your book, Fiscal Therapy, a book I encourage all of our listeners to go out and get a copy of. But before we get into the weeds, why don't we have you walk through what you believe to be the central problem of the U.S. fiscal system and why you decided to write Fiscal Therapy?
Sure. The central problem has two sides to it. One is the rising long-term debt profile. And I'm not talking about right now. I'm talking about 20, 30 years from now, the path we're headed on. And the other side of the coin, if you will, is the way we're generating that debt. That is the way we're choosing spending policies and tax policies. And you can imagine debt buildups that are not problematic. For example, if they are financing investment. But that's not what our debt buildup is doing. Our debt buildup is financing transfer payments. And so the issue is not just the rising debt, but the structure and level of taxes and spending policy. Why I chose to write a book about this is essentially because the problem is multifaceted. And I wanted to put it all together in one place for people to think about.
Yeah. You know, I think what seems to me to be most of the problem with our current fiscal predicament is, you know, it seems that Americans increasingly want more from government, yet we don't want to pay for it. There's a high demand for popular programs like Social Security, but raising taxes to maintain its solvency is anathema to most voters. And despite what those on the political right like to say about, you know, our tax burden, we have substantially lower taxes than other advanced economies. Payroll taxes are twice as large in other G7 countries. So isn't the first thing we need to do is to get Americans to start paying for the things they want from government?
I think that's a very good way to put it. The way I put it in the book is that it's not just a tax problem, not that taxes are too low. It's not just a spending issue. It's not that spending is too high. It's the combination of the two. It's like the two sides of the scissors are both needed to do the cutting. And so there are many ways to resolve the issue, lower spending, higher taxes. But it's the imbalance between the two, as you pointed out, that is driving the issue. The other thing you mentioned is our taxes are low relative to other countries. And that's definitely the case, especially, you know, consumption or sales taxes, payroll taxes, and energy taxes. Are much lower in the U.S. than in European countries, other advanced countries.
Yeah, you note multiple times in your book that our current fiscal problem can't be solved simply by cutting defense, spending, nor can we grow our way out of this problem. What growth rate would we need to maintain fiscal sustainability with our current rate of spending? And why is trying to achieve greater growth not what we need to be focused on?
So the growth rate we would need, given current spending, would be astronomical. I'm not sure exactly, but something like 5 or 6 or 7% per year GDP growth, real GDP growth. Historically, we've had 3%, and now we're looking at actually less than that because of the population growth. It won't be as large as it used to be. So better, more growth is a good thing, other things equal, but it's not going to get us out of the fiscal dilemma, both because realistically, we're not going to get anywhere near 5, 6, 7% on a sustained basis. There's no historical precedent for that. But the other reason that people don't notice this in the budget, that if the growth rate goes up, there's more demand for investment, so interest rates go up. The government borrows money, it pays a lot in net interest. So if interest rates go up, that makes the budget situation worse. If likewise, if we have a lot of growth, wages go up, right? Well, that raises future Social Security benefits, and that makes the budget situation more difficult as well. So there are these automatic mechanisms that curtail the benefits of growth on the fiscal situation. So growth is good, but it's not just appealing to more growth is not going to solve the long-term fiscal situation.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, I just feel like we've sort of allowed old age spending to run rampant while investing in our future in revenue positive projects has sort of been culled at every turn. You know, it seems we've become a country that borrows to spend rather than borrowing to invest. But having said this, isn't the high level of savings coupled with our low interest rate environment telling us that we aren't spending enough? I mean, just as lending creates deposits, government spending does create tax revenues. Why shouldn't we take advantage of historically low borrowing costs, create a 50-year treasury, and at least, you know, try to grow our way out of the problem? You know, you say we can't grow out of this, and I believe you, but you know, there are things that need to be done. You know, projects that have high economic multipliers like infrastructure and early age spending, you know, programs that essentially pay for themselves. So what do you say to that?
I think we should do those things. There's a distinction between the short-term situation and the long-term situation. And when I say growth alone won't solve the budget problem, it doesn't mean that growth is not worthwhile. I mean, I agree completely. There are important and productive investments the government can make in physical infrastructure, but even more so in humans, in early age, childhood, healthcare, etc. That could reap substantial economic benefits, and I don't want to rule out any of those. I think those are good ideas. I think also borrowing long right now to take advantage of low rates, I think on balance is a good idea, and we should pursue more of it.
Yeah, I think that we really should take advantage of what the market's given us. Bill, I wish everyone would read your book because it's so enlightening. It's so right on so many things. But I think the one area perhaps where you and I would disagree is on defense spending. You mentioned in your book that defense constitutes a relatively low share of federal spending, around 15% of the budget. I don't necessarily think 15% is a low number. When we spend more than the next 10 countries combined on defense, it seems quite substantial. So my question for you is, with, you know, 1 in 6 children living in poverty, and with all the other, you know, G7 countries spending twice as much on social assistance for families and children, why shouldn't we cut defense spending and increase our you know, money geared towards social assistance? But even if we didn't increase transfers to families, why won't cutting the defense budget alleviate the budget predicament that we're in?
This is a great question. I have several components to the answer. The most important one is I am not a defense expert. And so I was inherently leery of saying, oh, just cut this thing that I don't know that much about and everything will be fine. Obviously, there are defense and national security concerns that don't show up in the usual budget criteria that we look at. And so I didn't want to just sort of claim, there's nothing here, just take it away and cut the spending. Let me say a couple more things about defense spending there. One is it's fallen from about 10% of GDP to 10% of GDP over several decades since World War II. And that has helped finance a big increase in domestic spending. But that's been done. You can't do that again. Even if you cut defense from 3 to 0, 3% of GDP to 0, you would not cover projected increase in healthcare spending alone of 30 years. So I'm sure there are ways to cut the defense budget, but I'm not expert enough to know what they are. And my point is just, defense has been the source of defense cutting, the source of spending cuts for like the second half of the 20th century. And we just can't do that anymore. There's just not enough in the defense budget to finance the projected increases in other spending.
Right. And there's a real risk to doing that. So, let's get into some specifics on Social Security, and then we'll move on to healthcare. You note that Social Security accounts for 23% of federal spending, with Medicare being 14%, Medicaid 9%, defense 15%, and everything else 29%, with around 16% of that 29% being investments. In other words, spending in education, social services, science, transportation, infrastructure, et cetera. Why do you think we've allowed the proportion of actual investment to continue trending downward, and Social Security spending, a program that was not designed for 30 years of shuffleboard, to engulf so much of federal outlays? Social Security was designed for a select few elderly and disabled, not the masses, at its inception, which is why I very much like the proposal in your book of raising the retirement age gradually to 69. But don't we have to go beyond 69? And are there some other things besides raising the retirement age that we can do to keep Social Security solvent?
Yeah, Social Security started out as a relatively narrow program, and then it has it was expanded in pretty much a bipartisan way numerous times over decades, to the point where it's near universal now. Almost all workers, except some state and local government workers, are in the Social Security system. So I think that's probably here to stay. And it's the most I think it's probably the most popular government program. It's one of the most successful ones. And I think it does need reform, though, and raising the retirement age can and should be part of that, as I proposed. It's important, though, to note that some people are in jobs or have health conditions where they can't work to age 69. And so it's important to provide protections for them as the retirement age rises. And the book goes through some ways to do that. I just want to highlight that that group needs to have their needs addressed as we seriously bring the Social Security reforms system into balance. There's a number of ways to do that. I don't think the public is going to support benefit cuts. I actually, at this point, I don't think when push comes to shove, I don't think Congress is going to raise Social Security taxes or cut social benefits. I think they're going to borrow money to cover the Social Security shortfall. And that would be unprecedented. The same low interest rates that we discussed earlier that make investments so profitable or productive for government spending also make it less costly to borrow to finance Social Security shortfalls.
Yeah. So you think that they'll probably start, or they'll have to start pulling money from the general fund to cover Social Security?
Well, around 2033 or 2035, I don't remember the exact date, they will have to do something. They'll either have to cut benefits or raise payroll taxes or use general revenues. Historically, they've not used general revenues on a sustained basis. There's some emergency uses. Social Security is generally financed with its own taxes. And that's how Roosevelt wanted it, because he thought that once the taxes were in place, in his words, no politician can take away the benefits. But I don't see, if interest rates are low and the consensus becomes that deficits are not harmful, I don't see how Congress will muster up the courage to raise taxes or cut Social Security or cut benefits for Social Security. I mean, it's 15 years away, so we'll see. But it would be good for them to do something sooner, but I doubt that they will.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about healthcare. You note in your book that we are in this fiscal predicament largely because of our healthcare system. You said, we like to think that we have the world's best healthcare system, and in some ways we do, but too many people lack health insurance, which impairs their health and causes economic hardship. Also, our costs are too high. Healthcare spending has been rising for several decades, and counting both public and private outlays, we spend far more than any other country, with little difference in health outcomes. So I have two questions for you on the future of healthcare. First being, do you think that our new president President Biden, can find a way to get more people covered under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act? And second, what can we do about costs? I mean, in what world does a general physician deserve $218,000 a year on average? Doctors like to say they have hard jobs, but and they aren't overpaid because they are paid what the market can bear. But what they don't realize is that the U.S. government is the market, a large part of the market, and current and future taxpayers are the ones writing their checks. So what do you say to this?
Healthcare is, I think, the single most complicated area of policy, certainly the most complicated area of policy that I've looked at. I used to think taxes were complicated, but there is crazy. I think you highlight a really important point, which is about half the people in the country get their health care from the government. So the notion that the private market is doing its thing here has to be severely curtailed. The government in general and Medicare in particular are market leaders in terms of setting compensation rates, setting definitions of appropriate treatment and stuff like that. And I think the government needs to take more advantage of this. For example, Medicare is not allowed to negotiate on the price of the drugs that it covers, right? Estimates suggest that doing so would let it save $500 billion over the next 10 years. So that's something that Medicare pays more than Medicaid or VA, for example, pay for the same pharmaceuticals. So there are ways to cut costs. And Obamacare, and people think about the pre-existing, the prohibition of denial of coverage based on pre-existing conditions. They think about the insurance mandate, the mandate to purchase insurance. But one of the big things that Obamacare did that doesn't get talked about a lot was that it encouraged numerous research and medical practice experiments to learn more about what works and how costs can be contained. And those ongoing, I think it's fair to say the general result is there's some evidence of places to cut costs, but it's not as easy as some of the proponents might have thought. But this is going to be an ongoing process. Tax reform, you know, you change the tax system and you're done. Healthcare, it's going to be a process of continual adjustments. And I'm not quite sure that I have the answer. Healthcare was the one chapter where I felt like the proposals I put forward made a dent in the system, but didn't really resolve the underlying conflicts in the healthcare system.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can see that. It's an area that they're continually moving parts that are going to present problems, especially, you know, with our aging population. But let's move on to discuss, you know, the national debt a little bit more concretely. You know that the big issue of the national debt is that we have to pay interest that can pull money away from productive government programs, interest that to some degree is paid to foreigners rather than our own citizens, and an interest that is always a function of the prevailing interest rate environment. You know, if a country only borrowed from its citizens, interest, you know, really wouldn't matter. The right hand would be paying interest to the left hand for the left hand's investment in the right hand. You know, we in essence, interest would just be a reward for citizens investing in their future selves. But that isn't the world we live in, as the global community relies quite heavily on our current account deficit. We have a situation where interest is paid globally, and you know that takes away from money being invested at home. But having said all of this, is your real concern that our growing debt creates a situation where money is being sent to other countries and not being spent at home, or is it that a higher debt to GDP and thus larger interest payments are a threat to economic growth? What do the data tell us about debt to GDP and long-term growth rates? And can we be sure that there is, in fact, a causal relationship between the two?
Let's talk about history versus now. In terms of history, there's a big literature that concludes that since reduced growth, they long-term reduce investment rate. They raise interest rates. So the kind of basic theory of deficits crowding out other investments is supported in a lot of different ways, and there's a big literature on this. What's not clear is how all that literature applies when interest rates are zero or close to zero, as they are now. So right now, in terms of the short-term situation, we should stimulate because interest payments are low. They're not really a concern. We have this opportunity to improve the economy. We should take it. In the longer run, if interest rates stay low, we can run up a lot more debt than we previously thought we could. We just don't know what's going to happen to interest rates in 10 or 20 or 30 years. Right now, the market projections are suggesting that interest rates are going to stay relatively low for a fairly lengthy period of time. Other projections, like the Congressional Budget Office, suggest a rise. I don't know the answer. Nobody does. But the path of interest will be crucial to determining how bad the long-term debt problem actually turns out to be.
So, yeah, I think it's pretty tough to guess how interest rates are gonna go over the next 10, 15 years. Let's talking about growth. I think two of the biggest misconceptions are that high taxes limit growth, and that tax cuts pay for themselves through higher growth and increased tax revenues. When we look at the periods where the U.S. grew the fastest, it's during periods of high taxation and large government spending. And when we look at the years following large tax cuts, deficits increased significantly, and the reduced tax rates had little impact on economic growth. So, for those out there who are trying to wrap their head around this, shouldn't the lesson be that tax cuts certainly don't pay for themselves? One. But that some spending programs actually do, and that, tax increases really only stifle economic growth when there aren't corresponding increases in government spending. What is your take?
I think the concerns about the level of taxes and growth that we hear continually from conservatives, I think those concerns are greatly overstated. And let me give you just two examples. In the U.S., before World War I, total taxes were about 3% of GDP. Between the wars, they were about 10% of GDP. Since the wars, they've been about 20% of GDP. This is federal taxes. The per capita rate in those periods has been almost identical. Despite taxes going up from 3% GDP to 20% of GDP. So that cross-country evidence is basically the same. The OECD countries have taxes, total taxes, that are about a third higher than the U.S., but their per capita growth rate since 1970 has been basically the same as the U.S. And so these concerns that if we raise tax rates a little bit or we impose a new tax, we're going to destroy the economy, I think are just wrong, and have been, proven wrong by the evidence.
Yeah. Well, regardless, it's pretty clear that we have a real revenue problem. And what I loved most about your book was that you propose a value-added tax, a VAT, to help us raise revenue. Consumption is where the money is. It's 2/3 of our economy, and taxing consumption is something, in my opinion, the U.S. should have adopted long ago. So can you talk a little bit about why the U.S. doesn't have a VAT, your proposal for a VAT, and how we can make this rather regressive tax more progressive?
Sure. So a VAT is just a consumption tax. It's like a retail sales tax, but it's collected in a little bit in each stage of production rather than all at once at the retail level. Why we don't have it is a really interesting lesson in politics. Larry Summers, more than 30 years ago, said we don't have it because liberals think it's regressive and conservatives think it's a money machine that would generate cash to increase the size of government. And he said we will get a VAT essentially when liberals realize it's a money machine and conservatives realize it's regressive. And I thought that I don't think you can get a better description of the politics of the VAT in the United States. But it's very strange because VATs have been proposed in different forms by a variety of conservative Republicans, Paul Ryan, Herman Cain, Ted Cruz, others. They don't call them VATs because VATs have this image as this instrument of European socialism. So they call them business transfer taxes or something like that. But they're basically value-added taxes. And so everybody likes the structure of the VAT. Taxing consumption is efficient and fair and simpler than taxing income. But no conservative will get on board with something called a VAT because European countries have that, and they are supposedly these havens of big government and lazy workers, which is not accurate, but that's the stereotype. What I proposed to do was have a value-added tax, which is somewhat regressive, but not to stop there, because whether a policy is regressive depends on not only just on the money that's raised, but how the money is spent. And I proposed various ways of spending it, one of which was a universal basic income. And if you do that, if you spend about a third of the VAT on universal basic income, you can offset the cost of the tax in among the middle class, and you're essentially greatly subsidizing the bottom 40% of the income distribution. And it makes the net effect quite concentrated among high-income households. So it's an important lesson that we may come back to this later, but most of the redistribution among government policies occurs on the spending side, not the tax side. So with a little tinkering on the tax side, you can make a VAT a policy that subsidizes low-income households and concentrates taxes on high-income households.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it can be a great tool, and especially if we can use it in a progressive way, it would be wonderful because, we certainly have an inequality problem here in this country. So, I think I want to talk about inequality a little bit. I think another concept that many U.S. citizens fail to grasp is that taxes are not just used to raise government revenue. They are also our conduit to determining what level of inequality we would like to see reflected in society. You know, I think that the destruction of wealth at the top is just as important as the creation of wealth at the bottom, and most of that is done through the tax code. You said in your book that when you consider taxes and transfers, the U.S. has less redistribution than other advanced countries, ranking 27th, I think, in OECD countries out of 30. And high-income households have experienced skyrocketing income over the last 40 years, yet, you know, they've seen their effective tax rates go down. So when you look at these statistics, it's pretty clear that we have legislated inequality into our economic system. What is your view on the trajectory of American inequality and the tax code's direct impact on it.
So let's start with inequality. Some people say that concerns about inequality are just driven by envy. I think that's wrong. Inequality generates outcomes that are patently unfair to a wide swath of the population, and they're inefficient. They're wasted opportunities for society to benefit from the talents and the work of others. So it's being both inefficient and unfair makes inequality a particular target for policy. A particular concerning aspect of inequality is that it breeds future inequality. Now, kids that grow up in poor areas don't get access to good schools. That means they get less high quality education. That means they're qualified for less high quality jobs, et cetera. And so it gets perpetuated that way. So I think we need to take a much stronger stand on these issues, safety net issues and early childhood issues. One of the interesting things that I learned in writing the book was that the take-up rate for programs like TANF, Temporary Aid Assistance to Needy Families, and food stamps and low energy subsidies, the take-up rate for these programs is less than 25% of eligible households. So if we could just get the programs to people that are eligible for them, we could do an enormous amount of good. And in the book, what I tried to do was clear out 1% of GDP for spending on these types of initiatives. And I just think it's crucial, especially right now with the very unequal effects of COVID across race and income groups. It's crucial that we do more and do a lot more. As far as taxes on the top, I think there are ways we can raise taxes on high-income households that are not going to wreck the economy and that can generate resources that we can use to help low and moderate-income households.
Yeah, for sure. You know, what's interesting about, you know, everything we've talked today and the problems that we outline and you know what we need to do to get the country back on a stable fiscal path so that we can you know do more about it do more you know address inequality in a more reasonable way and you know fix our healthcare system and save Social Security is that a lot of this can be solved by closing the tax gap. Can you talk a little bit about the tax gap, you know, some of the things that we could do to close it and, you know, even if we could make filing simpler by collecting more revenue, by just having the IRS file our taxes for us?
The tax gap is one of the infuriating aspects of public policy. There's about $500-600 billion a year that Americans owe in taxes, the federal taxes that they don't pay. And most of that is because they simply don't report the income to the government. And most of it is among high-income households. And it's related to the structure of the tax system. When taxes are withheld by a third party and reported to the government, the evasion rate's almost zero. So for example, your wages get taxes withheld by your employer. The employer sends the taxes to the government, you know, and then when it's time to file your income tax, you reconcile those things. But the evasion rate on wages is less than 1%. In contrast, when there's no information reporting and no withholding, the evasion rates are estimated over 50%, sometimes as high as 2/3. And this is like farm income or rental income or a lot of pass-through businesses that are just simply not reporting the income and then hence not paying what they owe. And this is an enormous amount of money. It's $600 billion a year is 3% of GDP that we're never going to collect all of it, but we could collect a lot more of it basically by increasing the information reporting in the system and by increasing IRS enforcement capabilities. The IRS budget and personnel has been gutted over the last 25 years, and audit rates are way down, and quite naturally that makes it easier to evade taxes. So as an aside, the IRS computer systems need to be updated too. They're some of them should be in museums, not in offices. But this is a big challenge, and I think there is money out there, significant money that we can raise. Various people have made proposals recently that they think could raise $1 trillion over the next 10 years by closing a minority of the tax gap. Going after all of it, of course, would be very expensive. Just like if you have police, it doesn't mean there's no crime, but it cuts down on the amount of it. In the same way, better enforcement would reduce evasion, but it would never eliminate all of it.
Right. Yeah. Isn't providing more funding to the IRS like the most revenue positive project ever? I mean, I wonder what the multiple is for more tax enforcement. I mean, it just seems like, you know, the IRS is already underfunded, but you know, there's just so much money that we have really left on the table.
That's right. The multiples are on the range of between 4 and 11. That is, minimum estimates are you get $4 extra revenue for every dollar spent on enforcement, and the high end of the estimate is 11. But it's important to recognize that those are only the direct effects of the enforcement. That's only the money that they actually collect from the cases that they review. If it were made known that the IRS was cracking down on enforcement, you might get a lot of other people kind of voluntarily reporting more income that they quote forgot unquote in the past. And so you might raise the overall compliance rate that way and get revenue that's even more multiples of the original change in enforcement costs.
Wow. Well, Bill, my last question for you today is about politics. Almost everything we've discussed today is doable. It's easy to get done, yet in our political environment, it seems like an impossible feat to get both parties together to work these things out. What do you say to the policymakers on the Hill that have the power to implement some of your solutions but have failed to? What's your message to them?
So one of the messages of the book was that we could solve this problem with policies that are a set of policies that are realistic, that are administrable, that exist in various places. And so there are no radical proposals in the book. Nevertheless, the political constraints, are enormously difficult. I think I'm as cynical about the political system as anybody. I guess the way I think about it is they don't address issues when they need to address issues. They address issues when they have to address issues, when their back is against the wall.
Right.
And the problem with the debt is there's no back against the wall moment. There are manufactured back against the wall moment, like expiring tax cuts or debt limit increases, but they're not real. They're not real do or die situations. And so, I think it's going to, even under the best of circumstances, it would be hard to address these issues. I mean, the founding fathers made it difficult on purpose to enact big changes in government. And so even on the best of circumstances, as I said, it'll be hard. But in the current situation where there's seemingly little respect for facts or for the other side, I think it's gonna be particularly difficult. I will say the one shred of optimism I will leave with you here is that just because it's impossible now doesn't mean it'll be impossible in the future. And so people say, well, there's no solution right now. And that's right. That just means that whatever the solution ultimately is, it'll be something that right now people think is impossible.
Right.
So impossible things do happen sometimes eventually. And I should add too, I don't think this is going to get resolved in one big package deal.
Right.
I think that's just way too, it's way too many things going on for Congress to address all at once. But I think it'll happen in sort of a series of steps. That was kind of the idea behind fiscal therapy. You kind of like physical therapy, you need to keep working at it. But the other thing I would add is that presidential leadership, White House leadership, is crucial to this effort because the president basically needs to provide, you know, air cover basically by saying to the country, you know, everyone's going to lose a little, but this is an important issue. And I want your congressman to be working on this and reaching a constructive solution. Congress is inherently dominated by local concerns. And they just can't do this without leadership and protection from the White House.
Yeah, true. Well, Bill, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. I know our listeners and I have learned very much from you, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk about the book, and I'm gratified by your interest, and I hope people found the conversation interesting.
If you want to get more Bill Gale, his book, Fiscal Therapy, is available on the Demand Side's library page. And if you want to access all of Bill's research, visit brookings.edu. That's it for us here at the Demand Side. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion of what happened to fiscal policy with our very special guest, Bill Gale. Make sure to check out all the episodes of the Demand Side on the Demand Side's landing page, wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to visit thedemandside.com for access to opinion pieces, books, news, and videos. Thank you all for joining us this season. We will be back with 10 new episodes starting in April. But before we sign off, I want to give a shout out to all the people that have made this possible, the editors of thedemandside.com, all of our producers, and a special, special thank you to our executive producer, Ryan Snyder, and his team of video and sound editors. I couldn't do this without you. As always, my friends, if you're forced to choose sides, always choose the demand side. Until next time.